to episode 13 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winzenberg and me, Stephen Jones. This episode includes part two of our conversation with John P. Perkins. I wanted to take a moment to recommend John's podcast, Postulating Solutions with Preachers, which I help him and Pastor Matthew Watts produce. The next episode of Postulating Solutions includes recording artists Propaganda and John Foreman. Pastor Perkins also has a book, together with Anthony Bobo, called Commissioned to Love. Check it out at commissioncircles.com or check the show notes for details.
Have you seen any examples of where there have been powerful voices that have spoken out? In other words, what are some of the helpful movements that you've been seeing in the midst of all these trials that you think are accomplishing that?
I mean, I've seen it in the church and as well as outside of the church. And I'll be honest with you, outside of the church is winning, is whooping the church hands down. I mean, Black Lives Matter is whooping the church hands down in regards to it's unashamed to say, and it has the common man be unashamed to say. And that is what this has produced.
I just feel like in some ways we're deflecting what should be pretty obvious truths, right? And we're finding a lot of different ways to do that. Sure. What are some things that you've seen that have been encouraging in the church?
Boy, if y'all didn't see Al Sharpton's sermon, that was encouraging. Mm. I can't breathe what he preached at. I can't breathe. If you just get your foot off my neck, we could breathe. I ain't asking for no favors. Just get your foot off my neck. I don't want the society's foot on the neck of my boys, my two boys. Mm-hmm. I want a better life for them than I have. Edmund Gordon said it like this: the issue at hand today for Black folks as a race is that we lack resources and opportunity. That's really what we are explaining when we every time we lace them up and put on the headphones and step to the mic, Pastor Watts and I, my good friend and colleague and mentor, actually, when we do our podcast, Postulating Solutions with Preachers. Shameless plug there.
I think that's one of the things that's really interesting to me when we think about that podcast. So you guys are talking about different solutions to what people are facing. And I think one of the risks that we run, I mean, it reminds me of that TED Talk, The Danger of a Single Story. One of the risks that we run is trying to solve racism or solve racial injustice by just doing one thing. And I'm thinking about just this last week, you know, Pastor Watts has this 2020 initiative, the Justice and Equity Initiative. And then this week, you switched and you were talking about the church taking care of children in crisis. You know, you've got the barbershop going, you've got the lawn care going, you've got the church going, discipleship, mentoring, all these different things. And I think that one of the risks that we run is getting attached to one solution. And there's not, it's such a multi-layered set of issues.
Absolutely.
Isn't there some danger though too in getting frustrated, or I feel like I can feel overwhelmed and even knowing one step to take to try to be part of the solution. So I guess like, is there also a danger in spreading too thin where it's like, I don't even sometimes know concrete things that I can do to be part of the solution. So how do you kind of balance that sense of we don't want to be too narrow and think there's only one solution, but then we also don't want to get so overwhelmed where it's like, well, then we just don't do anything.
Yeah, that I mean, both are all right. So I'll just share from my perspective. I was raised around the philosophy of a holistic. It has to be holistic, son. If it ain't holistic, you're not doing community development, son. So if you're not working with the children, you're doing housing, and you ain't working with the children, you're not doing community development. You know, it's got to be a holistic approach. And so we have to have capacity. The church has to have capacity, particularly when it works amongst the poor. And, you know, what hurts my feelings? You want to know what hurts my feelings? Can I tell you what hurts my feelings?
Let's hear it.
When I hear my white brothers tell me, or they pray, can we, Lord, help us to be colorblind? I said, if you colorblind, you can't see me. Because I'm black. Mm-hmm. And we down here in the hood, and we struggling. Our schools are failing, and we don't want no favors. We want the textbooks. If these children had the textbooks that the suburb kids had, and if they had the computers that the suburban kids had, and they had the Cat 5 cabling running to the school, that the suburban kid had, and they had the opportunity at home to be able to do that, you would see competition. Mm-hmm. You would see competition in the urban public schools. But when you know you bring it home a worksheet and you know it's not the best, you know it's inferior to something else, you kind of have a mindset that continues to perpetuate, and it turns in on itself. And that's where we get sort of like a poverty mindset. And that's what we're trying to, that's what we're fighting, you know, that's what we're fighting. So that's where we have to be responsible and not point the finger, because the slaves, they didn't do it. They didn't do that. Booker T. Washington, he didn't do that. He walked 400 miles to go to school. He walked 400 miles from West Virginia. 400 miles, because he wanted an education. 400 miles. And from there, he went to Tuskegee and saw that these folks didn't have nothing and said, we're going to build something. I made my kids read this book this summer. I said, y'all, your daddy is going to be your teacher. I'm glad COVID-19. So now I'm setting the curriculum. I'm setting the curriculum. Yeah. Up from slavery. This is what you need to know right here. This is what you need to know. And so I said, oh, look. I asked my children, Booker, what time did Booker have to get up and go to work? Look, I had to get up and go to work at 4:00 in the morning to pack salt, to go to school in the afternoon. Y'all hear me? 4:00 in the morning to pack salt, to be able to go to school at 11, to be able to do it in the afternoon. And you had W.E.B. Du Bois and him, they had a meeting of the minds, you should say, a debate over a period of years, a sparring session over a period of years. And the day that Booker died, he said, W.E.B. Du Bois said, a piece of me died. Mm. That's how powerful Booker was.
How'd your kids react to the story, to reading it?
They loved the story. They loved it. And so they're reading more books. They're reading more of the books right now. They're reading the autobiography of Malcolm X by Alex Haley. I want them reading above their heads.
I know you've got to get going here. I'm just thinking, there's 1,000 conversations that we could have, you know, so I guess you'll have to come back.
I hope you wouldn't have me back. I hope I'm invited back to have a cup of coffee with my professor.
So before we go, as we go here, so something you asked Pastor Watts on the postulating solutions, right? You ask him, give us some hope, right? Mm-hmm. So before you go here, can you give us some hope?
Yeah, my hope is in the fact that Jesus says, I have come that you might have life and that you might have it more abundantly. Right now, things don't look too good. But we know he has come that we can experience life in an abundant way. And the only way in which that is if we are doing what we're doing and experiencing life together. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm. Thanks so much, John, for sharing with us. I wish we had more time to talk more and to just hear your thoughts on things. I'm bummed that when you're in Minneapolis, I didn't have a chance to spend more time with you last time you were here. But I wish you well, brother, and I hope you have safe travels and everything too.
God bless you.
Yeah, thanks so much for being with us. We'll look forward to having you back probably before too long.
And thank you all for having me.
So before John joined us, we were just talking about the question of colorblindness, and he brought it up there a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that idea, and he said it, you know, is that if you're colorblind, you don't see me, mm-hmm. right? You don't see my experience. You don't see my people, my history. And I think that's the issue with colorblindness. If our goal is colorblindness, like there's kind of this sense of moving toward normal, right? I don't see you as different. Well, one of the things about whiteness in America is that we often conflate whiteness and normal as being the same experience. And of course, normal is this really problematic idea.
No kidding.
And so, you know, if we say, I see you as normal, is kind of what we mean when we say, I don't see color, that can actually be, its own form of silencing somebody else.
I feel like there can be this minimization too, or the fact that I think some of the sentiment of being colorblind is this idea of like, well, everybody has equal value. Everybody's inherently worth the same in their humanity. And that I think is a good sentiment, but there can be this minimization of other people's experiences that are very different from one's own, and it can be almost the sense of like, well, we all experience the world the same, which clearly isn't true. Right. And that would be a major danger in saying, well, I don't see color or I don't see difference, is that then are you not recognizing that there are people in our country who are experiencing a great deal of difference because of the color of their skin? And are you actually just minimizing that fact or trying to erase it or trying to ignore it? I think that would be one of the major dangers of this idea of trying to be colorblind, is just minimizing the actual lived experiences of people who are very different.
And some of those lived experiences, some of those things that would be that we risk not seeing are beautiful and wonderful things.
Yeah.
Right.
I think we're not talking just about the bad things.
No, I think in context, a lot of times what we mean is I don't see you as being less than me or something like that.
Yeah.
But part of what's so offensive about that is, you know, each cultural group has its own really amazing contributions. And whether that's, you know, it's maybe easier to see sometimes in the arts or things, but, you know, one of the places you and I are looking for that is in theology.
Yeah.
And if we explain away or we fail to see some of the unique contributions that come from these different cultural perspectives in theology, I think we end up sometimes missing some of what God is wanting us to see.
Yeah, I always kind of inherently believe that I'm wrong about some things, but that my own vision, my own blind spots aren't easily recognizable from myself, from my own vantage point. And what I've noticed is that experiencing the way that people theologize from various cultural perspectives and from various lived experiences has helped me see my own blind spots. So those are the negative things, the things that I'm wrong about and that I don't pay attention to that I need to. It can go the other way though too. You know, it can be something that is just completely enriching in seeing, seeing variety and nuance to the picture of who God is, of who humanity is in ways that I also don't see. So it goes all those ways. It challenges areas that I'm blind to that I need to be corrected on at times. And it also adds richness. And I think that's part of the what fascinates me about seeing the way that people theologize and think about God and think about people from vantage points that are different than my own experience and the things that I can see. It's what I love about the class that we co-teach together called Contextualization, Transformation, and Global Theology. Mm-hmm. And as much as that's a mouthful of a title, the goal to actually read and experience the way that people theologize and think theologically from different cultural perspectives and experiencing that not just simply as a frightening thing, because I think there can be this tendency sometimes to think the more that we understand that people think very differently about God, it can feel threatening, like, well, then what's true?
Right.
But actually, there is this beauty component that needs to be elevated, that can actually dissipate some of that fear and recognizing that actually these portraits and these varied portraits can provide beauty in ways that are not frightening, but liberating.
Which is actually something that we see with the Gospels.
Exactly. Yeah. And think about that even on a minor, or not a minor, maybe call it a micro level, right? Of the different perspectives on Jesus that are given in the four Gospels and not seeing those as actually frightening differences, but seeing those as enriching differences that don't have to come down to who was right and who was wrong as much as how does that person's perspective on these events actually give us nuanced and beautiful portraits of the actual situations that happened.
I want to go back to the other half of what we were talking about before John joined us, because we talked about the issue of not moving toward color blindness, but moving toward deracialized theology and deracialized perceptions of each other. And John mentioned something about that too, where he said there's this tendency sometimes for him to perceive the world overly through race. And there's one of the big problems with that. So race as we know it is made up, right? Mm-hmm. It's a figment of our imagination. And of course, it has effect. It has real effects in society.
So can you explain a little bit? Because I think this might be helpful for listeners too. You know, there's a lot of hype going around about doing these like DNA tests, you know, to find out your cultural heritage and all this, you know, in trying to discover, you know, where you come from. Draw some distinctions for us a little bit in the difference between race and what people are finding out when they get those results back.
Sure.
Because it would make it seem like race then is something like built into our blood, as if you could take a blood test and it will tell you what race you are. But explain some of the differences there, I think.
Yeah. So the big difference is that the racial typologies that we're familiar with really only have three or four races. And we have assumed a level of biological difference that we believe is connected with something visible, specifically skin color. Right. Mm-hmm. There are a few other features that we sometimes connect with that, and that we really act like these are separate strands of humanity. And there's just that doesn't exist. There clearly are biological differences between groups of people. Right. But not in anywhere near as defined of categories as we imagine that they are. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some, you know, there are kinds of diseases that are primarily within groups, but the group boundaries are much better explained by something like ethnicity than they are by the idea of race. Race, as we know it, was invented in the U.S. And there have been distinctions between groups of humanity made throughout history. But the race that, you know, as we understand it, is an American invention. And it was an economic invention used to, you know, categorize groups of people. And so there was, with race, this idea that some groups were more evolved than other groups. Darwin was certainly not the only evolutionist. There was evolutionary thought brought to a lot of different fields of study. Mm-hmm. And of course, because it was white people making the typology, whiteness was the, you know, the apex of humanity. Like all the other groups had not yet evolved to be as far along as whiteness. Well, that there's just no justification for that biologically. Mm. And even if you look at, there's this great series from California Newsreel called Race, the Power of an Illusion. And it talks about just how awkwardly race has been constructed. Mm. Like, how much non-whiteness do you have to have in order to be considered non-white? Well, that actually has varied from state to state. It gives an example where if you're in one state and you walk across the state line, you might go from being white to being black or vice versa. And those kinds of things where we begin to see, like, actually what we take for granted is not at all true.
What's interesting is what sounds like you're saying then is that race is a social construct.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if that's true, then why is it so important that we understand that race is a social construct?
If we forget that race is a social construct, we start looking for it in places that it doesn't belong. Mm. So here's a place that it does belong. If you want to understand health disparities between Black Americans and white Americans, understanding the impact of the social construct of race is really, really important. So the lived experience of being Black in America has certain impacts on people's health, whether that's because of stress. There are all sorts of things that go, that, you know, these things all connect together. But where we shouldn't look for race is in the Bible, right? Mm. Which actually a lot of American theologians did through the 19th century. And I'm specifically thinking of the 19th century, just around some of these great debates of whether slavery should continue or not. And people were justifying their belief about what was happening in American slavery based on reading race into scripture. Well, race was not, American race was not in scripture, right? Mm-hmm. Because we didn't invent American race until much, much later. So all of this has a really significant, when we want to think about something like the killing of George Floyd, if we use race to say there are two different humanities, which is really what we're doing, right? Mm-hmm. With race, we're saying there's my humanity and your humanity, and they're not the same. The solution that we've come to say colorblindness is to say we're all one race. Yes, we're all one human race, but there is this different cultural experience, right? So here's maybe the complexity that we have to get to is to say George Floyd is exactly as human as I am. Mm-hmm. And there's no distinction in our humanity. There is a difference in our lived experience connected to the racial typologies that we use in American society, which means that his death at the hands of the police ties into this much larger lived experience and
historical social narrative present in our country.
And saying that I don't see that is nonsensical.
In our country, mm-hmm. because of the color of their skin,
right.
And I can't say with certainty. I don't know exactly how a person may have been treated otherwise, but I think I can speculate because of the racialization of things in America and because of our history that there is unequal treatment, right, mm-hmm. for people because of the color of their skin,
right.
And so that is important.
I'm curious. Yeah, what else stood out to you about what John had to say?
You know, we're in a spot where we're understanding the narratives that we're feeding our children. Jill and I are in this spot where we understand, I mean, and by children, I guess I should say child, because Lucas isn't old enough to really read or hear narratives much. You know, he's still newborn. But when it comes to our 3.5-year-old, we're understanding that we've made some intentional and some unintentional choices about the narratives that he hears and that he encounters. Mm-hmm. When John was sharing a bit about now it's dad's time to educate, you know, and now that school is out but needs to continue on, you know, here's my curriculum. And I've been a little bit aware now of some of the ways that I haven't done a fantastic job of ensuring that my children are hearing narratives other than the ones that I might just naturally gravitate towards. And certainly hearing narratives from people other than white voices or white male voices. And that's also been brought to my attention with my teaching. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about this, I think just you and I have talked about this before in the past. So I think John's point about, you know, what stories he's sharing with his children right now, it stuck with me because it's making me realize a little bit the necessity to be more intentional with what stories I'm having my children hear and read in ways that will give them a broader perspective than what I would maybe have done so far.
I was talking with somebody recently who had moved out of an urban context into a suburban context, and they were realizing that, so this is a white person, and she was realizing that choice actually had more impact on her kids' education than she had realized, in the sense that without intending to, she's ended up now in a situation where her kids will probably go to school primarily with white people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the histories that we forget about, things like redlining and other things, mm-hmm. that have led to wealth disparities, that lead to these differences in quality of school systems and that kind of stuff. And she's found herself in a situation where her kids will be lacking the voice of non-white peers unless she takes really serious steps to find those relationships, find those opportunities. And it's so interesting how we can grow up, like what's around us becomes normal. And there are so many Americans for whom it's normal not to hear somebody from another cultural perspective, even though we actually don't live that far apart in many cases.
Or what we end up doing is having these sort of anecdotes of experiences with people that then form further prejudices. It's interesting because I feel like I've known some people where they maybe have wanted, they know that fact that their kids are going to school with mostly white people. And then they have maybe tried to make some sort of, you know, concessions to ensure that doesn't happen. And then it leads to maybe one awkward event or bad event. And then it perpetuates this idea of like, see, this is why this, I don't know. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't really know how to put it.
Yeah. Well, it becomes another form of tokenizing, right?
Exactly. That too.
I mean, it's one of the things that we run into with our teaching, right? You know, our textbook selection, it's things that we run into. Yeah. You know, trying to, I think there's something different between exposing people to diverse perspectives and actually living in fellowship with.
That's true. And there's always the danger. I've seen this happen where people will bring in other perspectives in the classroom as other perspectives.
Right.
Meaning that it continues to other that perspective, mm-hmm. as like, here's the normative, what I'm teaching. And then here's something else that's like this extra flavor or divergent view that is maybe even dangerous. Like that's a danger. But then sometimes people can feel the sense, or some professors maybe can feel a sense of like, well, I brought in the other view, but it's like, well, no, you didn't treat it with respect. You didn't treat it as a view worthy of hearing. You treated it as a way to shoot down another person's view and uphold your own. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's a tricky thing to balance, but I think an important distinction. And yet you want to be evaluative of all views, right? Without just holding everything up as somehow having no difference.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's tension. We try to do some of that intentionally, valuing viewpoints other than the ones that people would hear from you and I as professors, meaning our own sort of lived experience and views in our class that we co-teach together. And I feel like we've got some ways to go yet, but we also have made some good strides. Mm-hmm.
I feel, as I'm thinking about this episode, I feel unsatisfied.
Yeah, I do too, actually.
And I think...
I don't know why.
I think it's because there's so much. There's just so much, right?
Yeah.
And so it feels like, yeah. So what's one thing that you are doing this week to try to press into that?
You know, something Jill and I have been talking about, Jill's been doing a lot better job with this than I have, but something that we're talking a lot about is trying to take concrete steps now to supporting either organizations or various causes that we believe might make a direct impact. Whether I know whether they will or not, I don't always know, because these aren't necessarily friends of ours who have an organization that we're like, yeah, it's mostly things that people who we respect, people whose voices I think need to be heard in society, who have made us aware of some of these organizations, and we're trying to do things like donate and whatnot. It's a small thing, but I feel like it moves away from the theoretical to the more tangible. Mm-hmm. And you and I, you know, we've wrestled in the past with this, because you and I love to talk a lot about theory, and we like to have, you know, like to theorize about solutions to things and things like that. But that can cause me sometimes not to take actual action towards something. And there's always this fear of like, well, but what if I take action and it's not the right solution? Mm-hmm. But rather than let it paralyze us, it's like Jill found some organizations and causes she and her research thought was worthy. And I'm like, I'm on board. Let's do it. So we've done that.
Yes.
I don't know how big of an impact that would ever make, but I think it's a step that's beyond sometimes where I naturally gravitate towards. How about for you?
Yeah. I think the one thing that I might try to do this week is, it's probably not temporal. I think it's more of an attitude shift. You know, we were talking earlier about how when there's something that you've been thinking about for a long time, it can kind of be a little bit uncomfortable when other people start talking about it and thinking about it. It feels like the thing can kind of get hijacked and become cheapened, or sometimes end up going in a different direction than you were expecting. And I think because of that, I risk acting like or believing that I've got it figured out. Mm. And that is problematic. Mm. You know, I think, you know, I mean, for really legitimate reasons, my focus has been on other things with the, you know, my dissertation and other things. Like I had done work around issues of race earlier, you know, 13 years ago when I was prepping my first culture anthropology class. I did a lot of work on that. Well, that's old, you know, that's And I think that there's a sense in which I probably need to update some of my understanding of some of these things. I think even some of the awkwardness, you know, as we've tried to talk through this today, is because it's not fresh for me. Mm. And I think instead of being defensive about that, I need to step back and realize, like, okay, in terms of principles, I feel pretty solid about some of these things. In terms of, you know, the factual basis, I think I need to update my, not only my ability to articulate it, but really my understanding of it. And to come back now, you know, I've grown epistemologically in the last 13 years. So to go back and say, okay, does what I think that I know fit with the way that I know now? Or, you know, and I think that what that really means is I have to humble myself. And so instead of looking at people who have never engaged these topics before and being like, well, what are you, you know, either being like, well, finally, or being like, you know, well, you don't understand anything. I've been thinking about this for so long. And on the one hand, I have. And on the other hand, that doesn't mean that I understand it better. It just means I understand it longer, you know?
Yeah.
which can... Yeah, if I don't stay curious about that, I think that actually I end up risking perpetuating all sorts of things that I don't want to.
Thank you for joining us for Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. We have a wealth of information for you in this week's show notes. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. We hope you can join us for coffee again next week.